You're listening to Resurrection Life Podcast with your hosts, Father Steve Mattson and Richard Budd, the podcast of the Church of the Resurrection in Lansing, Michigan. In today's episode, we talk about witness to love. We hear a reflection on the sixth beatitude, Blessed are the poor in heart. And we listen to a classical guitar piece composed by Antonio Lauro, Valse Criollo, played by Kyler McGillicuddy. Welcome to Resurrection Life Podcast. Welcome to another episode of Resurrection Life Podcast. This is your host, Richard Budd, and with me as always,
Father Steve.
Welcome to the new year, Father. 2025.
Thank you. Likewise, yeah. Happy New Year. And we're recording this still in the official season of Christmas. Mm-hmm. Baptism of the Lord will be this Sunday. We're recording on a Friday.
Yeah.
A little snow falling outside, which I figure if it's going to be cold, we might as well have a little bit of snow anyway.
Yeah, that's kind of my take. If it's going to be cold, just give me snow. Give me lots of snow. Do not give me 37 in rain. That's the worst part of it.
Gray.
Yeah.
37 rain. That's the worst. I mean, this is the clouds of darkness that the Lord came to
this
to
is
remedy.
Not the cloud of witnesses that
no,
we were promised.
No. This is, we need the light shining in the darkness.
Yeah.
And so we are each of that, us that, and the people who listen, all of us who are baptized are the lights mm-hmm. that the Lord has given to the world.
As the clock struck midnight on 2025, I just couldn't help but, I don't know, have now mixed emotions.
Did it strike midnight on 2024? Or do you see? What is
midnight?
I mean, it's 12 midnight, midnight is a.m., right?
It's the weirdest thing. The 12 is the first,
stage.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So. But that Y2K was a quarter century ago, and that I clearly remember that means
the apocalyptic threats did not come to fruition. So we know that the Lord would tarry at least 25 more years.
Yeah, I told Maureen, I know I'm starting to get older because all of my memories are 20 and 30 years old.
Just wait till you can have 50-year-old memories.
Speaking of Epiphany and New Year and everything, we've got a new altar.
Yes, so the unveiling, the manifestation, this past few days, the crew from Cleveland who worked with some marble that was cut in Italy have installed the altar and the altar of repose. And on the back of the altar, there's a slot. There'll be eight or nine relics, I can't remember exactly the number, that will be placed in the altar and then sealed after the fact. There underneath the mensa, the tabletop, which will be the consecrated space for the sacrifice of the Mass. The altar of repose is also set up there, right beneath the reredos with the crucifix and Blessed Mother and John the Beloved Disciple. And we're looking forward early this coming week, so you will see it by the time you hear this. The newly plated old tabernacle. It wasn't our old one. It was from someplace else. That'll be in the placed on the altar of repose, and we'll have our old candlesticks and crucifix on a wooden altar until the dedication, which would be on January 25th.
Okay. I think it's a particular fascination for a lot of Catholics about the relics in the altar. Would you mind sharing which saints that we'll have in our altar?
Yeah, so if my memory serves, it is Saint Andrew. These are the ones that were in the altar, I suspect originally in 1922. Yeah. So Andrew, Matthew, Mark, Blaise, Saint Blaise. I believe Saint Januarius. Mm. No, I'm sure Saint Januarius. Saint Agnes and Saint Agatha.
Oh, nice.
I think
a lot of early
that,
martyrs.
Also Saint Sebastian. Did I say that?
No, but okay. I was wondering.
I think that's the eight.
Okay. And if you wouldn't mind speaking a little bit about why we put the So the martyrs under there?
In the book of Revelation, we see mm-hmm. that they are underneath the altar.
Yeah.
I love that. And the first
they're
time
crying out for God for justice.
Exactly right. And so we have that. I mean, that's a great list. I was talking to Monsignor Lunsford, and if I'm not mistaken, they just have three relics in the cathedral altar.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I can't remember them offhand, but...
they should just make resurrection the cathedral.
Right. I'm not saying that, but I will say this, that I think there'll be some maybe positive pressure to renovate the cathedral, given the beauty that the Lord, through inspiration and also the skills of architects and workmen and craftsmen who have made it possible. So we've ordered new furnishings, so the celebrant's chair, a concelebrant's chair, or deacon chair, and a new credence table that will complement, and it's the same woodworker who did the reredos.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of the lasting blessings of the Witness to Hope Fund from
indeed
about, what, 10 years ago or whatever that
yeah,
was.
Yeah, it began in 2017.
So this is, we're seeing churches all over the diocese.
That's right.
You know, trying to re-beautify and really bring the sacred back to the
sanctuary. I think this is there's a hunger, there's an appetite for it. And I was telling someone, I think it was Monsignor Lunsford, I was just telling him that one of the things that was unexpected, but I should have had I reflected on it at all, that the gift that the communion rail or the altar rail gives is I get to see people anticipating receiving, and there's no rush. People can behold the heavenly liturgy in the sanctuary as they kneel there, especially those who come to receive in the center. And we're getting close to the fact that people are used to it now. They don't have to think about it so much, though I think on the sides, there's still a bit of confusion, but eventually we'll get a trifold flyer in there just talking about the renovation and also just how we invite people to come up, either kneeling or standing at the communion rail.
I'm usually just busy admonishing my children.
That's right. It is interesting. Because people are kneeling, you don't always know how tall the individual is. So there can be a question sometimes. Does he or she receive?
Oh, yeah, right? Sure. So, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well.
No, but it's been wonderful. I'm so grateful for patience and the generosity of the parishioners. I'm grateful for Chris and his work with all of the contractors and the other staff members on our team and elsewhere that made this possible.
Well, I've said this to you off air, but just it's been so edifying to see the small details that are meaningful. Everything from like the front of the altar being the lamb on the book of the seven seals, because we're celebrating the heavenly liturgy. The cubical shape of that's the right sanctuary, because the heavenly Jerusalem is a cube. Just all these different things I've just kind of delighted in seeing. Are the, I'm forgetting what they're called, the top...
the finials.
Finials. Are those meant to look like Easter lilies?
I don't know.
They kind of make me think of that.
Yeah, I think that... So there's some... wooden reliefs of lilies
that
surround that. Mm-hmm. The reredos. And there's definitely, if it's not lilies, it is to indicate new life.
Yeah.
Kind of. And so I'll have to find out more about finials before we, you know, get the trifold explainer there. But I'm so grateful for Joseph Macklin's work on the icons that he wrote, and they just draw me in so powerfully.
They do not strike me as a modern artist's work. They look ancient.
Well, and I'll say that the wood seems medieval. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense in which we added it, but it looks older than the church.
It does, yeah. And you know, just speaking of the church the wider church, we've gone through periods of what's called iconoclasm in the past, where there's kind of this action against images. And I think it's fair to say there was an iconoclastic period between, you know, in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, right.
But if you look at the history of the church, any time that that happens, what follows is this great period of artistic fervor. And so I'm hoping maybe we're starting to see the beginning of that.
Absolutely, and grateful that a young Catholic architect helped us with a lot of the design work locally, and then Philip Breckler, who did the design of the ambo, the altar of repose, the reredos, and the furniture. He's Greg Engel's cousin, Philip Breckler, he lives in Indiana, and just so grateful for this new generation of really artisans and artists.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Well, again, as we move into 2025, the parish is moving to a newer form of marriage preparation. We're going to talk about this today. Something that the universal...
Perhaps we should have the person from the diocese who's in charge of family and marriage.
That might be helpful.
So glad you're here. So if you didn't know that, Rich...
Yeah, my job is to be the marriage and family director for Bishop Boyer at the diocesan chancery. But for about the last 40 years, the church has been calling us to think about marriage preparation in a similar way that we think about the RCIA, or now we call it the OCIA process, a catechumenal way.
Order of Christian initiation, as opposed to rite, because there's many rites.
Yeah. An order is a collection of rites, mm-hmm. and so it was a bit of a misnomer to call it the rite of Christian initiation. And what that essentially means is the order of Christian initiation, the catechumenal process, is meant to bring a person from kind of this place of burgeoning faith to full discipleship and reflection in the mysteries that they are receiving. And so all forms of sacramental preparation that should be the goal, to bring a person from one point of their faith into a fuller maturation. Everything from baptismal preparation, but also holy orders, matrimony, first communion, confirmation, etc. And so way back in 1981, John Paul II was pointing us to the fact that marriage preparation, which is a relatively new thing in the life of the church. Before, if you wanted to get married, you just showed up, you know, we're talking hundreds of years ago, but mm-hmm. you just show up at the parish and you'd set a date with the priest in a couple of weeks and you'd get married, because what prepared you for marriage was family life and kind of the normal Christian culture that people lived in. What the fathers of the Second Vatican Council and prior to that recognized was society and families were not really preparing well couples to be entering into the sacrament of matrimony. And so this process of preparing couples for matrimony began. And then John Paul II and others, most recently Pope Francis, have pointed out marriage needed to look more like a catechumenate. And so down in the chancery at the diocese, we've been working on trying to help parishes throughout the diocese reflect more this process of a catechumenal path, to help couples, even if they're going to Mass every Sunday and, you know, they're faithful, well-discipled Christians, they can still enter more deeply into the mysteries. And so everybody can move more deeply into it. And one of the tools that we're going to use here at Resurrection is a program called Witness to Love. And what Witness to Love is it's a mentoring model where couples are invited to build friendships with other married couples in the parish. What's distinct about Witness to Love, and it's really kind of based on psychological science, is the couple themselves choose, with some guidance from the parish, who their mentor is going to be. Typically, what we find is the parish chooses some couples, they train them through some sort of training program, and then they get assigned to the engaged couples as needed. But what we found was to properly be mentored by somebody, you need to have some sort of attraction to them. And while we might find a certain couple as a parish administrator attractive, the engaged couple might not know them from Adam or might not know anything about them that would make them attractive. And so by letting the couple choose their own mentor, that you kind of jump that first step.
And there's some criteria that mm-hmm. they should use for that, and maybe talk a little bit about what those minimal criteria are in terms of their the choices that a couple might make.
Sure. Ultimately, I think...
Married 5 years, right?
Yeah, married 5 years. But the first step... at least 5 years. The first step I was just going to say is the pastor has to be part of the discernment. So if they bring somebody, the pastor knows his people better than, you know, the engaged couple. And so he might know a particular reason that isn't public knowledge, why maybe isn't the right time for that particular married couple to be chosen. So, but...
And just to be very clear, the expectation of these mentor couples is not that they've got perfect marriages, because no one has a perfect marriage.
Yeah.
So it's I think those who are, as I think about it, this could be as much a help to the couple that's preparing as much it'll be a help to the mentoring couple mm-hmm. as well as it is to the couple that's preparing mm-hmm. to get married.
Yeah.
So and mentor and mentee.
I don't even mean to imply that the married couple might have some marital troubles. They might have just lost a child. Mm-hmm. You know, have other stresses in their life that right now wouldn't be a good time. And so the pastor would be able to help with that. But that's you kind of got a little bit ahead of me there. What we're seeing across the diocese is the parishes that have embraced this model, it's not only good for the engaged couples, it's really good for the married couples to give of themselves in this way. It also calls them to reflect on their own marriage and to kind of maybe focus on some aspects of their own marriage that need attention. But back to those minimum requirements, 5 years practicing Catholics, don't have to be perfectly practicing. And then finally, they have to be a couple that the engaged couple would want their own family to look like eventually. There has to be something attractive in them. Mm-hmm. And so the process would be, they would, you know, the newly engaged couple would come to the parish, they'd get some orientation on the marriage preparation process, and then we'd ask them, okay, we want you to look around the church on Sunday and think about who you might want to ask. Let us know who you plan on asking. We'll kind of give you the go ahead or look a different area. And then once everything's good, the engaged couple would just ask the married couple if they'd consider being the mentor couple. And the only thing I would say to the married couples in our parish at this point is, if you can't do it, you can't do it. So you should never feel...
What are the expectations in terms of time commitments that a couple that might be selected by...
Sure.
A couple preparing for marriage would expect to have to spend?
I would say you're going to have it at the very least 6 formal meetings where you discuss virtue and nothing that needs any particular training. There's
materials,
a workbook that you kind of you work through together. And it's stuff that we all have to deal with as married couples. Like, what is the place of humility or patience in a marriage? And you can talk about your experiences, where you've learned, where you had strengths, where you learned you had weaknesses, what you did about it, etc. And so I think for anybody, this to be asked could be intimidating, because you might feel nervous about taking on that responsibility. But I would say the greatest gift that you have to offer these couples is your marriage. And that's what the sacrament of matrimony is anyways. The catechism calls it the sacrament of service along with holy orders. And so one of the things it says in the catechism about matrimony and orders is these sacraments are ordered toward the salvation of others. And if it brings about the salvation of yourself, it's only because of the service to others that it brought about your salvation. And so I would encourage people to be generous. If you can't do it, you can't do it. but to try to be generous. On top of those six formal meetings, couples are encouraged to go to Mass together, to go on double dates together, to pray together. Essentially, you're asked to build a friendship with this couple, one that ideally would go beyond the wedding day, and you continue to kind of be a natural mentor to this newly married couple as they enter into all of the complications of building a home together and the things that happen in the early years of marriage. You're right alongside this couple with them. We've seen throughout the diocese mentor couples become godparents to the new little babies, which I think is the ideal kind of situation where you've reached the point where now you've got a child, you're bringing this child into the faith, and the people that you want to influence your child the most are the people that influenced you.
And here we've been using kind of trained mentors who go through the focus inventory, which is basically about communications and making sure that you're dealing with important issues that couples sometimes don't see eye to eye about, and also a program that used to be called Preparing to Live in Love, but is, I think, now called A Lasting Promise, or, no, what's it called?
Preparing to Live in Love is...
Lasting Promise is the communications course.
Yeah. All right. It's something like ELL or... I forget what the new name is. They change these names on these programs.
Right.
I wish they just leave them alone.
That's right. So Lasting Promise is something that we also invite people to go through to just figure out how can you effectively disagree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
make sure that the other
person, imagine that you're going to disagree.
But the program that used to be called Preparing to Live in Love, we're still in a period of time where some of those lessons are going to be continue to be taught by trained mentors. So there'd be kind of the main mentor couple, which would be the Witness to Love, and then this other couple that will help.
They're more specialized.
Specialized in kind of the formation side of the theology of the body, really informing that self-gift. So there's going to be a lot of overlap there, but I don't think we can... over-prepare people for any sacrament, especially a vocation.
Yeah, and in my experience, married couples that are asked to be mentors feel under-equipped as if, well, I don't have any special training. And that's kind of one of the reasons that we're talking about this today is that anybody that's listening, the idea isn't that you have special training. It's that you have your marriage that you can give to this young couple, but you also have the experience of living. You have experience in life
Fact is, if you've heard me preach, you know that I don't pretend to have it all right all the time. Mm-hmm. None of us does. And that kind of honest lessons learned will be invaluable. I know the theory. Mm-hmm. You couples who are married know the practice, right?
Yeah.
And I hear, but you can speak first person of the give and take that is necessary to have a successful marriage.
Yeah, similarly. I mean, I was in seminary. I came, 18 months away from priesthood. I know the theory of being a pastor, but I don't know the ins and outs.
That's
right. I think it would be wrong for me to assume I do.
Yeah.
So we try to, it's good to understand the other, but, we talk all the time about the community of believers and how we're supposed to be responsible for each other. This is a really practical way in which.
I want to just echo what Rich said, which is if you get approached, be open and prayerful about it. You don't have to have it all together. We are in this together, helping each other get to the destination called heaven. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think there is something about your relationship that has brought you to their attention.
Yeah.
And not for no reason. Mm-hmm. And so the Lord works through that to strengthen and to encourage you as well as them.
Yeah. And I know what it's like to not want your sores to be seen by others. I think I got this from my mother. Whenever there's company coming over, I get really stressed about whether or not the house is clean.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
And so I turn into a tyrant in the home, like, you know, getting everybody to get up and clean the house, you know, so-and-so's coming over. And
there's something healthy about it, but also for us to say, all right, you know what? We're human.
Yeah.
You know, I don't ever regret inviting me over or another priest to come bless your house if it isn't perfectly tidy. The priest's house is not perfectly tidy. It's not a pigsty, but it's not perfectly tidy. You can be assured of that.
Well, my children's bedrooms are currently pigsties. So.
I've been there.
So I have been very enthusiastic about this program now for 10 years. Yeah. I have seen it work 98% of the time. Very well. I know the founders of the program. I know what type of people they are. They are good, holy, committed Catholics. Some of the science and the psychology that is written in underneath in the background came from psychologists that went to Divine Mercy University in Virginia, which is I think the top psychological school, Catholic psychological school in the country. And so there's a lot of science behind it, but there's also just a lot of like human nature behind it as well. And so
that's great.
Enthusiastic.
Well, I look forward to seeing how it works out here. And again, want to encourage you to pray for the couples who are preparing to marry, to get married. And then also not to be surprised if a couple might at some point nominate you to consider being their mentor couple.
So once again, the program's called Witness to Love. So if you hear that phrase around the parish, you know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
All right. Well, any last words, Father, as we close out this episode?
Well, let's, as we begin the new year, we're anticipating a new administration in Washington, D.C., and we don't know what the future will hold, but we do know that the Lord has it, and He's invited us into it, and we're here for a reason. So let's live as witnesses to love, whether we're mentor couples or just Christians. Yeah. Just Christians.
All right. For another week, this is Rich.
Father Steve.
God bless. In the Beatitudes, Jesus gives us an outline of the Christian character. His whole ministry was a work of mercy to the world. In the following reflection from Sean O'Neill, we explore the sixth Beatitude, Blessed are the pure in heart, and what it means for our own lives.
Blessed are the pure in heart. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 8, we read, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." What does it mean to be pure in heart? Traditionally, this primarily refers to sexual purity. For example, in his sermon on the Beatitudes, chapter 12, paragraph 33, St. Augustine comments on this beatitude. Here's what he says, quoting the sayings of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5. "You have heard that it was said to them of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. The lesser righteousness, therefore, is not to commit adultery by carnal connection, but the greater righteousness of the kingdom of God is not to commit adultery in the heart." In this sense, adultery in the heart may mean not indulging in sexual fantasy. Of course, our thoughts can be stimulated in this way if we don't take precautions to avoid near occasions of sin. Many of the saints, when talking about how to combat sexual temptation, advise not fighting valiantly to overcome temptation, but rather running away from the source of temptation. In practice, what this involves is adopting an astute and wry attitude towards our ability to fight sexual temptation and avoiding those situations in which we know we will be tempted. The same goes for how we relate to each other. It's easy for mild flirtation and innuendo to creep into our conversation with co-workers, friends, or even family members. So it's important to stand guard over what we say and the way we express ourselves to make sure that we are maintaining a pure heart. Does this mean that we should be constantly vigilant in this area? Yes, it does. As St. Paul urges us in 2 Corinthians 10:5, take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. Augustine talks about purity of heart as being like single-mindedness. He refers to that passage in Ezekiel that speaks of God's tender care for his people. When the people return to their homeland, they will remove every trace of their vile images and detestable idols. And I will give them singleness of heart and put a new spirit within them. I will take away their stony, stubborn hearts and give them a tender, responsive heart, so they will obey my decrees and regulations. Then they will truly be my people and I will be their God. So in single-mindedness, not only should we protect ourselves from carnal lust and those things that lead us into sins against the virtue of chastity, but we should also not entertain passion for any other rival to God in our lives. For example, if we are obsessed with the latest news or the latest sports results or comments people make in social media or the latest episode of our favourite TV show or on anything else that draws us away from our relationship with God or threatens to crowd him out, then we should take steps to curb those passions, to restrict our exposure to those things and to hold lightly the things of earth. Being pure in heart also involves not giving in to idle curiosity about the lives of others, not indulging in gossip or detraction. At what point does speaking about another person or the latest news become gossip? Perhaps it becomes gossip when we start to share something about another person that puts them in a bad light and leads people to think of that person in an unfavourable way. And it becomes detraction when we deliberately share someone else's sins or faults, thus damaging their reputation. The Catholic Encyclopedia describes detraction as the unjust damaging of another's good name by the revelation of some fault or crime of which that other is really guilty or at any rate is seriously believed to be guilty by the defamer. In a sense, growing in purity of heart consists in growing in all of the virtues. It involves regaining our original innocence, even after we have been contaminated by the world. This is what that passage from Ezekiel means. If we persevere, God will take away our stony and stubborn heart and give us a tender, responsive heart, so we will obey his decrees and regulations. Perhaps we feel that we have a stubborn heart. For example, because we have persistent sin in our lives that seems to be intractable. Perhaps we have a heart of stone and lack empathy with others because we have been hurt so many times ourselves in the past. God wants to heal our damaged hearts and allow us to experience his love. The purpose of maintaining a pure heart is not to be prudish or to deny our feelings or to look down on other people whom we consider to be not as virtuous as we are. The point of purifying our hearts is so that we remove obstacles to our complete union with God. In practice, what this means is that God is the focus, not us. When our hearts are not pure, when they are not single-mindedly pursuing a relationship with God, but are distracted by and attached to worldly concerns, allurements, and frivolous indulgences, we make it difficult for God to reach us. St. Ignatius says that God is constantly trying to break into our lives with love. When our hearts are divided, we begin to close off access to our lives and switch the focus from the Lord to ourselves and whatever our new distraction might be. Why is Jesus concerned with purity of heart? We read the answer to that in 1 Samuel 16:7. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. We may have all sorts of opinions about other people. We may judge them on the basis of their behaviour, their words, or what we have been told about them. But God is not so interested in how we appear to each other. He's interested in what's going on in our hearts. In Matthew 15, 18 to 20, Jesus tells us what God is interested in. The things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart, and these defile them. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander. These are what defile a person, but eating with unwashed hands does not defile them. God is so merciful that even if in this life we have not developed purity of heart, he has provided a place where we can be purified. It's called purgatory. Purgatory purifies the heart and enables a person to be ready to see God. In purgatory, we allow the love of God to burn away all of our attachments to the things of earth. We let the Lord heal us of all the damage that we have accumulated in our lives and invite him to eradicate from our lives the effects of sin that still remain when we passed from this world. Of course, purgatory is a last resort, as it were. The ideal is to be so purified by the time we die that we go straight to heaven. While on earth, we can develop a pure heart, that is, a heart that is undivided and totally for God, through detaching ourselves from the concerns, the affections, and the attachments of the world. To that end, we can pray to God for purity of heart. We can enlist the help, the intercession, and the encouragement of our Blessed Mother and of the saints. They are in our corner, rooting for us and cheering us on. In fact, although God will appear at the end of time as a just judge and weigh our deeds, good and bad, in the balance, he too is on our side in the fight for purity and virtue and holiness. Let's pray now for purity of heart. Heavenly Father, bless us with purity of heart. Remove from us the things of this world that cling to us and tarnish the loving image that you have of us and that you want us to grow into. Strengthen us and help us to move ever more closely into the life you want us to lead, a life of purity, holiness, and love of you. And help us to respond readily to your action in our lives and so be transformed into men and women who are worthy to be presented to you when we pass from the world and come before you. Amen.
We finish this episode with a classical guitar piece composed by Antonio Lauro, Vals Criollo, played by Kyler McGillicuddy. You've enjoyed this episode of Resurrection Life Podcast. Please tune in next time for more conversation, reflections, and Catholic culture. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to drop us a line to give us feedback or suggest future topics to feature, write us at podcast@corelansing.org. You can find the Church of the Resurrection online at corelansing.org. Thanks for listening, and God bless.